Enfield first. Melissa wore a red silk sheath. Her long blonde hair was pinned back on one side. She reminded Casanova of a young Grace Kelly. "Have you been saving yourself for me?" the gentleman asked. Melissa's smile was demure. "I've been saving my heart for someone." Will Rudolph smiled at the clever answer. He ran the back of his hand across her cheek. He let his hand slowly track down her throat and over her firm breasts. She submitted without showing fear or revulsion. That was one of the rules when the games were played. "You're very, very good at our little game," he said. "You're a worthy player, Melissa." Naomi Cross was next in line. She had on an ivory cocktail dress, very chic. She would have been the belle at some Washington law firm's ball. The scent of her perfume made Casanova feel a little giddy. He had been tempted to declare her off-limits to the gentleman. He wasn't fond of her uncle, Alex Cross, after all. "We might come back to visit with Naomi," the gentleman said. He lightly kissed her hand. "Enchanté." Rudolph nodded, then stopped at the sixth woman in the receiving line. He turned his head and checked out the final girl. Then his eyes returned to number six. "You're very special," he spoke softly, almost shyly. "Extraordinary, actually." "This is Krista," Casanova said with a knowing smile. "Krista is my date for tonight," the gentleman exclaimed in an enthusiastic voice. He'd made his choice. Casanova had given him a present, to do with as he pleased. Krista Akers tried to smile. That was the house rule. But she couldn't. That was what the gentleman especially liked about her. The delicious fear in her eyes. He was ready to play Kiss the Girls one last time. Part 5. Kiss the Girls. Chapter 102. The morning after the arrest of Dr. Wick Sachs, Casanova strolled the corridors of the Duke Medical Center. He calmly turned into Kate McTiernan's private room. He could go anywhere now. He was free again. "Hello, my darling. How goes the wars?" he whispered to Kate. She was all by her lonesome, though there was still a Durham policeman stationed on the floor. Casanova sat on the straight-backed chair beside her bed. He looked at the sad physical wreck that had once been such an outstanding beauty. He wasn't even angry with Kate anymore. There wasn't much to be angry with now, was there? "The lights are still on," he thought, as he stared into the vacant brown eyes. "But there's nobody home, is there, Katie?" He enjoyed being in her hospital room. It got his juices going, turned him on, moved his spirit toward great things. Actually, just sitting beside Kate McTiernan's bed made him feel at peace. That was important now. There were decisions to be made. How exactly to handle the situation with Dr. Wick Sachs? Did more tinder need to be thrown on that fire? Or would that be overkill and therefore dangerous in itself? Another tricky decision would have to be made soon. Did he and Rudolph still have to leave the Research Triangle area? He didn't want to. This was home. But maybe it had to be. And how about Will Rudolph? He had clearly been emotionally disturbed in California. He had been taking Valium, Halcyon, and Xanax. That Casanova knew of. Sooner or later, he was going to blow it for both of them, wasn't he? On the other hand, it had been so unbearably lonely when Rudolph was away. He'd felt cut in half. Casanova heard a noise behind him at the hospital room door. He turned and smiled at the man. "I was just leaving, Alex," he said, and got up from the chair. "No change here." "What a damn shame." Alex Cross let Casanova slide by him and out the door. He fit in anywhere, Casanova thought to himself as he walked away and down the hospital corridor. He was never going to be caught. He had the perfect mask. Chapter 103. There was a fine old upright piano inside the barroom at the Washington Duke Inn. I was there playing Big Joe Turner and Blind Lemon Jefferson tunes between 4 and 5 one morning. I played the blues, the blahs, the doldrums, the grumps, the red ass. The hotel maintenance staff sure was impressed. I was trying to put everything I knew together. I kept circling back to the same big 3 or 4 points, my pillars to build the investigation on. Perfect crimes, both here and in California. The killer's knowledge of crime scenes and police forensics. Twinning between the monsters. Male bonding as it had never existed. The disappearing house in the woods. A house had actually disappeared. How could that happen? Casanova's harem of special women. But even more than that, the rejects. Dr. Wick Sachs was a college professor with questionable morals and actions. But was he a stone-cold murderer without a conscience? Was he the animal who had imprisoned a dozen or more young women somewhere near Durham and Chapel Hill? Was he a modern-day de Sade? I didn't think so. I believed, I was almost certain, that the Durham police had arrested the wrong man and that the real Casanova was out there laughing at all of us. Maybe it was even worse than that. Maybe he was stalking another woman. Later that morning I made my usual visit to Kate at Duke Medical Center. She was still deep in a coma, still listed as grave. The Durham police no longer had an officer on guard outside her room. I sat vigil beside her and tried not to think about the way she had been. I held her hand for an hour and quietly talked to her. Her hand was limp, almost lifeless. I missed Kate so much. She couldn't respond, and that created a gaping, painful hole in my chest. Finally, I had to leave. I needed to lose myself in my work. From the hospital, Samson and I drove to the home of Louis Freed in Chapel Hill. I'd asked Dr. Freed to prepare a special map of the Waikagill River area for us. The 77-year-old history professor had done his job well. I hoped the map might help Samson and me find the disappearing house. The idea came to me after reading several newspaper accounts of the Golden Couple murder case. Over 12 years ago, Roe Tierney's body had been found near an abandoned farm where runaway slaves had once been hidden in large underground cellars. These cellars were like small houses under the earth, some with as many as a dozen rooms or compartments. Small houses under the earth? The disappearing house? There was a house out there somewhere. Houses didn't disappear. Chapter 104. Samson and I drove to Brigadoon, North Carolina. We planned a hike through the woods to where Kate had been found in the Waikagill River. Ray Bradbury had once written that, "Living at risk is jumping off a cliff and building your wings on the way down." Samson and I were getting ready to jump. As we trudged into the foreboding woods, the towering oaks and Carolina pines began to shut out all light. A chorus of cicadas was thick as molasses around us. The air wasn't moving. I could imagine, I could see Kate running through these same dark green woods only a few weeks earlier, fighting for her life. I thought of her now surviving on life support systems. I could hear the machines whoosh-click, whoosh-click. Just the thought hurt my heart. "I don't like it in the deep, dark woods," Samson confessed as we passed under a thick umbrella of twisted vines and tent-like treetops. He had on a Cypress Hill t-shirt, his Ray-Ban sunglasses, jeans, work boots. "Reminds me of Hansel and Gretel. Melodramatic bullshit, man. Hated that story when I was a little kid." "You were never a little kid," I reminded him. "You were 6 foot when you were 11, and you already had your cold stare down to a fine art." "Maybe so, but I hated those Grimm brothers. Dark side of the German mind, turning out nasty fantasies to warp the minds of little German children. Must have worked, too." Samson had me smiling again with his warped theories of our warped world. "You're not afraid going through the DC projects at night, but a nice walk in these woods gets you? Nothing can hurt you here. Pine trees, muscadine grapevines, briar, brambles. Looks sinister, maybe, but it's harmless."
"Looks sinister is sinister. That's my motto."
Samson was struggling to get his statuesque body through closely bunched saplings and honeysuckle at the edge of the woods. The honeysuckle was actually like a mesh curtain in places. It seemed to grow tangled. I wondered if Casanova might be watching us. I suspected that he was a very patient watcher. Both he and Will Rudolph were very clever, organized, and careful. They had been doing this for a lot of years and hadn't been caught yet. "How's your history on the slaves in this area?" I asked Samson as we walked. I wanted his mind off poisonous snakes and dangling snake-like vines. I needed him concentrating on the killer, or maybe the killers, who might be cohabiting these woods with us. "I've dabbled with some Edie Genovese, some Muhammad Awad," he said. I couldn't tell if he was serious. Samson is well-read for a man of action. "The Underground Railroad was active in this area. Runaway slaves and whole families heading north were kept safe for days, even weeks, at some of the local farms. They were called stations," I said. "That's what Dr. Freed's map shows. That's what his book was written about."
"I don't see any farms, Dr. Livingston. Just this muscadine grapevine shit," Samson complained and pushed away more branches with his long arms.
"The big tobacco farms used to be west of here. They've been deserted for almost 60 years. Remember I told you that a student from UNC was brutally raped and murdered back in 1981? Her decomposed body was found out here. I think Rudolph and possibly Casanova killed her. That's around the time they first met. Dr. Freed's map shows the locations of the old Underground Railroad. Most of the farms in the area where runaway slaves were hidden. Some of the farms had expanded cellars, even underground living quarters. The farms themselves are gone now. There's nothing to see from aerial surveillance. The honeysuckle and brambles have grown thick, too. The cellars are still here, though.
Humph. Your handy-dandy map tell us where all the old-time tobacco farms used to be?"
"Yep. Got a map, got a compass. Got my Glock pistol, too," I said, and patted my holster.
"Most important," Samson said, "you got me."
"That, too. God save the miscreants from the two of us." Samson and I walked a long, long way into the hot, damp, buggy afternoon. We managed to find three of the farm sites where tobacco leaf had once flourished, where terrified black men and women, sometimes whole families, had been taken in and hidden in old cellars as they tried to escape to freedom in the north, to cities like Washington, D.C. Two of the cellars were located exactly where Dr. Freed said they would be. Antique wood planks and twisted, rusted metal were the only signs left of the original farms. It was as if some angry god had come down and destroyed the scene of the old slave-owning ways. Around 4 p.m, Samson and I arrived at the once proud and successful farm of Jason Snyder and his family.
"How do you know we're here?"
Samson looked around at the small, desolate and deserted area where I had stopped walking.
"Says so on Dr. Louis Freed's hand-drawn map. Same compass points. He's a famous historian, so it must be true."
Samson was right, though. There was nothing to see. Jason Snyder's farm had completely disappeared, just as Kate had said it would. Chapter 105.
"Blaze gives me the creeps," Samson said. "So-called tobacco farm."
What was once the Snyder farm was particularly eerie and otherworldly, creepy as hell. There was almost no visual evidence that anyone human had ever lived here. Still, I could feel the blood and bones of the slaves as I stood before the disturbing ruins of the old tobacco farm. Sassafras trees, arrowwood shrubs, honeysuckle, and poison ivy had grown up to the level of my chin. Red and white oaks, sycamores, and a few sweet gum trees stood tall and mature where a prosperous farm had once been. But the farm itself had disappeared. I felt a cold spot at the center of my chest. Was this the bad place, then? Could we be near the house of horror that Kate had described? We had worked our way north, and now east. We weren't too far from the state highway, where I wished I had the car parked. According to my rough calculations, we couldn't be more than 2 or 3 miles from the state road.
"Search parties for Casanova never came all the way back in here," Samson said as he prowled around. "Undergrowth's real thick, real nasty. Not trampled down anywhere I can see."
Dr. Freed said he was probably the last person to come out and examine each of the old Underground Railroad sites. The woods were getting too thick and overgrown for casual visitors, I said.
Blood and bones of my ancestors. That was a powerful, almost overwhelming notion, to walk where slaves were once held captive for years.
No one ever came to rescue them. No one cared. No detectives back then went looking for human monsters who stole entire black families from their homes. I used natural landmarks from the map to locate where the original Snyder cellar might have been. I was also trying to brace myself in case we found something I didn't want to find. We are probably looking for a very old trap door, I told Samson. There isn't anything specific marked on Freed's map. The cellar is supposed to be 40 to 50 feet west of those sycamores. I think those are the right trees, and we should be right over the cellar now. But where the hell is the door?
Probably where nobody would walk on it by mistake, Samson figured.
He was making a path into the thicker, wilder undergrowth. Beyond the tangle of vines, there was an open field or meadow, where tobacco had once been planted and grown. Beyond that was more thick woods. The air was hot and still. Samson was getting impatient, and he knocked down Honeysuckle with a vengeance. He was stamping his feet, trying to locate the hidden door. He listened for a hollow sound, some kind of wood or metal, under the tall grass and thickly tangled weeds. This was originally a very large cellar on two levels. Casanova might have expanded it. Built something grander for his house of horror, I said, as I searched through the heavy undergrowth. I thought of Naomi kept underneath the ground for so long. She had been my obsession all of these days and weeks. She still was. Samson had been right about these woods. They were eerie, and I felt we were standing at an evil place where forbidden secretive things had been done. Naomi could be somewhere close by, underneath the ground.
You getting hoodoo spooky on me again? Trying to think like this nutty squirrel? You sure Dr. Emeritus Sachs isn't Casanova? Samson asked as he worked.
No, I'm not. But I don't know why the Durham PD arrested him either. How did they just happen to find out the underwear was there? How did the underwear get in his house in the first place?
Because maybe he is Casanova, sugar. Because maybe he put the victim's underwear there so he could sniff it on rainy afternoons. FBI and Durham crime fighter is going to close down the case now.
If there isn't another killing or abduction for a while, once they shut the case, the real Casanova can relax, plan for the future. Samson stood up tall and stretched his long neck. He sighed, and then he moaned loudly. His T-shirt was soaked through with sweat. He peered up at the overhanging vines.
We got a long walk back to the car. Long, dark, hot, buggy walk.
Not yet. Stick with me on this. I didn't want to leave and stop our search for the day. Having Samson around again was a major plus. There were still three more farms on Dr. Freed's map. Two of them sounded promising. The other seemed as if it might be too small. So maybe that was the very one Casanova had chosen for his hideaway. He was a contrarian, wasn't he?
So was I.
I wanted to keep searching through the night. Dark woods or not, black snakes and copperheads or not, twin killers or not. I remembered Kate's terrifying stories about the disappearing house and what went on inside. What had really happened to Kate the day she escaped? If the house wasn't in these woods, where in God's name was it? It had to be underground. Nothing else made sense. Nothing made any goddamn sense yet. Unless someone had purposefully cleared away every last remnant of the farm. Unless someone had used the old wood for other building purposes. I finally took out my pistol and searched around for something, anything, to shoot at. Samson watched me out of the corner of his eye, curious but not saying anything yet. I needed to get some anger out, release some venom, some stress, right here and now. There was nothing to target shoot at, though. No underground house of horror, but also no rotting planks from the farmhouse or barn. Not one remnant that I had seen. I finally fired a round at the knobby trunk of a nearby tree. In my incipient craziness, a knot in the tree resembled the head of a man like Casanova. I fired again and again. All direct hits, dead solid perfect. I had killed Casanova.
Feel better now? Sampson peered over the top of his Ray-Ban sunglasses at me. You hit the bogeyman in his evil eye?
I feel a little better, not much. I showed him my thumb and forefinger, spread about a millimeter apart.
Sampson leaned against a small tree that looked like a human skeleton. The little sapling wasn't getting enough light. I do think it's time we packed up and left, he said.
That was when we heard screams. Women's screams were coming from under the ground. The screams were muffled, but we could hear them clearly all the same. They were to the north of us, and even farther into the thick bramble, but closer to the open meadow beyond the old tobacco fields. A tightly wound ball of tension hit me with tremendous force at the sound of the voices under the ground. My head slumped involuntarily toward my chest.
Sampson took out his Glock and squeezed off two quick shots. More signals for the trapped women, for whoever was screaming under the ground. The muffled screams were getting louder, rising as if from the tenth circle of hell.
"Sweet baby Jesus," I whispered. "We found them, John. We found the House of Horror."
Chapter 106 Sampson and I got down on our hands and knees. We searched frantically for the hidden entryway into the underground house, running our fingers and palms over the undergrowth until they were cut and bleeding. I looked down and my hands were shaking. I fired off several more gunshots so the women trapped below would know we'd heard them, and that we were still up here. After I fired the shots, I quickly reloaded.
"We're up here!"
I yelled, with my head close to the ground. The weeds and grass were scratching my face.
"We're police!"
"Here we go, Alex," Sampson called to me. "The door's over here. There's some kind of door, anyway."
Running through the high, thick weeds was like wading in water. The trap door was hidden in honeysuckle and waist-high grass, where Sampson had been searching. The door had been covered over with an extra layer of sod and a thick blanket of pine needles. The door wasn't likely to be found by a search party or anyone else hiking through the woods.
"I'll go down first," I told Sampson.
Blood roared and echoed in my ears. Usually, he would have argued. Not this time. I hurried, rumbling down a steep, narrow wooden stairway that looked as if it had been there for 100 years. Sampson followed close behind. The Good Twins. "Stop," I told myself. "Slow it down." At the bottom of the stairs there was a second doorway. The heavy oak plank door looked new, as if it had been installed recently, possibly in the past year or two. I slowly turned the handle. The door was locked.
"I'm coming in,"
I shouted to anyone who might be behind the door. Then I fired 2 rounds into the lock, and it disintegrated. The wooden door heaved open with a hard shove from my shoulder. I was finally inside the House of Horror. What I saw made me retch. A woman's body was laid out on a couch in what appeared to be a well-appointed living room. The corpse had begun to decompose. The features were unrecognizable. Maggots were swarming all over the victim.
"Move," I had to tell myself. "Go. Go now."
"I'm right behind you," Sampson whispered in his deep homicide scene voice.
"Watch yourself now, Alex."
"This is the police," I called out.
My voice was shaky and getting hoarse. I was afraid of what else we might find in the hideaway. Was Naomi still here? Was she still alive?
"We're down here," a woman called out. "Can anybody hear me?"
"We hear you. We're coming,"
I shouted again.
"Please, help us,"
a second voice sounded farther away in the underground house.
"Be careful. He's tricky."
"See? He's tricky," Sampson whispered, never at a loss.
"He's in the house. He's in here now!"
One of the women shouted a warning to us. Sampson was still standing behind me, keeping close.
"You want to keep the point, partner? Walk on the ridge line?"
"I want to be the one to find her," I told him. "I have to find Scoochie."
He didn't argue. "You think Loverboy is down here someplace, Casanova?" he whispered.
"That's the rumor going around," I said, and moved forward slowly. Both of us had our guns drawn and ready. We had no idea what to expect next. Was Loverboy waiting for us?
"Move, move, move those legs."
I led the way out of the deserted living room. There were high-tech lamps in the ceiling of the adjoining hallway. How was he able to get electricity in here? A transformer? A generator? What should that tell me? That he was handy? That he had connections with a local electric company?
How long had it taken to get the underground cellar in this condition, I wondered. To fix it up like this. To make his fantasy come true. The space was extensive. We entered a long hallway that snaked off the living room to the right. There were doors on either side, and they were bolt-locked from the outside, like prison cells.
"Watch our backs," I said to Samson. "I'm going in door number one."
"I always watch your back," he whispered.
"Watch your back, too."
I went up to the first door. "This is the police," I called out. "I'm Detective Alex Cross. Everything's going to be all right."
I yanked open the first door and peered inside. I wanted it to be Naomi. I prayed that it was.
Chapter 107
"Such utter fools," said the gentleman, intolerant and impatient, as always. "Two carnival clowns in blackface."
Casanova smiled thinly, growing impatient with the gentleman.
"What the hell did you expect? Brain surgeons from Walter Reed in Washington? They're a couple of ordinary street cops."
"Not so ordinary, perhaps. They found the house, didn't they? They're inside right now."
The two friends watched everything coming together from a nearby hiding place in the woods. They had tracked the detectives all afternoon, observing them with binoculars. Plotting, planning, but also playing with their prey. They were careful as they moved in for the final confrontation.
"Why didn't they bring the others out here? Why didn't they bring the FBI?" Rudolph asked.
He was always inquisitive and very logical.
A logic machine. A killing machine. But a machine that ran without a human heart.
Casanova looked through the powerful German binoculars again. He could see the open trap door that led down into the underground house, the masterpiece that he and Rudolph had built by hand.
"It's their policeman's arrogance," he finally answered Rudolph's question.
"In some ways they're like us. Cross is especially. He trusts himself and no one else."
He glanced over at Will Rudolph, and both men smiled. The irony was beautiful, actually. The two detectives against the two of them.
"Cross probably thinks he understands us, our relationship, that is," Rudolph said. "Maybe he does, a little bit."
He had been paranoid about Alex Cross since the close call in California. Cross had tracked him down, after all, and that frightened him. But the gentleman also found Cross interesting as an opponent. He enjoyed the competition, the blood sport.
"He understands some things. He sees patterns, so he thinks he knows more than he actually does. Just be patient, and we'll expose Cross's weaknesses."
As long as they were patient, Casanova believed, as long as they thought everything through carefully, they would win. They would never be caught. It had been that way for years, from the first day they met at Duke University. Casanova knew that Will Rudolph had been careless out in California. He'd had that disturbing tendency even as a brilliant medical student. He was impatient and had been sloppy and melodramatic when he killed Roe Tierney and Tom Hutchinson. He had almost been caught back then. He was questioned by the police and had been a serious suspect in the famous case. Casanova thought about Alex Cross again, evaluating the detective's strengths and weaknesses. Cross was careful, and he was a thorough professional. He almost always thought things through before he acted. He was certainly smarter than the rest of the pack. A cop and a psychologist. He'd found the hideaway, hadn't he? He'd gotten this far, closer than all the others. John Sampson was more impulsive. He was the weak point, though he certainly didn't look it. He was physically powerful, but he would be the one to break first, and breaking Sampson would break Cross. The two detectives were close friends. They were extremely emotional about each other.
"It was stupid for us to split up a year ago to go our separate ways," Casanova said to his only real friend in the world. "If we hadn't begun to compete and play egocentric games, Cross would never have found out anything about us. He wouldn't have found you, and we wouldn't have to kill the girls and destroy the house now."
"Let me take care of the good Dr. Cross," Rudolph said.
He didn't react to the things Casanova had just said. Rudolph never showed much emotion, but actually he'd been lonely too. He'd come back, hadn't he?
"No one takes care of Dr. Cross alone," Casanova said.
We'll go after them together. We make it two against one, the way we work best. First Samson, then Alex Cross. I know how he'll react. I know how he thinks. I've been watching him. Actually, I've been hunting Alex Cross since he came to the South. The two human monsters moved closer to the house. Chapter 108. I switched on overhead lights in the first room, and I saw one of the captive women. Maria Jane Capaldi, cowered like a frightened little girl against the far wall. I knew who she was. I'd met her parents a week or so back. I had seen old, cherished photographs of her.
"Please don't hurt me. I can't take any more of this,"
Maria Jane pleaded in a hoarse whisper. She was hugging herself, rocking gently back and forth. She had on ripped black tights and a wrinkled Nirvana t-shirt. Maria Jane was just 19 years old, an art major and aspiring painter at North Carolina State in Raleigh.
"I'm a police detective," I whispered in the softest voice possible. "Nobody can hurt you now. We won't let them."
Maria Jane moaned, and she began to cry tears of relief. Her whole body was quivering.
"He can't hurt you now, Maria Jane," I reassured her in the softest voice I could manage. I could barely speak, actually. "I have to find the others. I'll be back, I promise you. I'm leaving your door open. You can come out. You're safe now."
I had to help the others. His harem of special women was right here. Naomi was one of them. I broke into the next room in the passageway. I still couldn't catch my breath. I was exhilarated, frightened, saddened, all at the same time. A tall blonde woman in the room told me her name was Melissa Stanfield. I remembered the name. She was in nursing school. I had so many questions, but there was time for only one. I gently touched her shoulder. She shuddered, then collapsed against me.
"Do you know where Naomi Cross is?" I asked her.
"I'm not sure," Melissa said. "I don't know the whole layout here."
She shook her head and began to cry. I don't think she even knew who I was talking about.
"You're safe now. The nightmare is finally over, Melissa." "Let me help the others," I whispered.
Out in the hall again, I saw Samson unbolt a door. I heard him say,
"I'm a police detective. It's safe now." His voice was soft. Samson the gentle.
The women we had freed were wandering, dazed and confused, out of the prison rooms. They hugged one another in the hallway. Most of them were sobbing, but I could feel their relief, even their joy. Someone had finally come to help them. I entered a second hallway at the end of the first. There were more locked doors. Was Naomi here? Was she alive? The pounding in my chest was unbearable. I opened the first door on the right, and there she was. There was Scoochie, the best sight in the entire world. Tears finally streamed from my eyes. I was the one who couldn't talk now. I thought that I would have a permanent memory of everything that happened between the two of us. Every word, look, nuance.
"I knew you'd come for me, Alex," Naomi said.
She staggered into my arms and held me tightly.
"Oh, sweet, sweet Naomi," I whispered.
I felt as if thousands of pounds had been lifted off me.
"This makes it worth everything. Well, almost."
I had to look at her up close. I held her precious face in both my hands. She seemed so fragile and tiny in the room. But she was alive. I had finally found her. I called out for Samson.
"I found Naomi. We found her, John. In here. We're in here."
Scoochie and I folded into each other's arms, just like old times. If I had regretted becoming a detective at any other time, this made up for it. I realized now that I'd thought she was dead. I just couldn't give up the fight. Never give up.
"I knew you'd be here just like this. I dreamed it. I lived for this instant. I prayed every day, and here you are."
Naomi managed the most wonderful smile I have ever seen.
"I love you."
"I love you, too. I missed you like crazy. Everybody did."
After a moment, I gently pulled away from Naomi. I remembered about the monsters and the way they had to be thinking now, still plotting everything. Leopold and Loeb, all grown up, committing perfect crimes.
"Are you sure you're okay?"
I smiled finally, the beginning of a smile anyway. I could see some of the old intensity returning to Naomi's eyes.
"Alex, go," Get the others out, she urged me. Please let the others out of these cages he kept us in.
Just then a strange, terrible sound echoed in the passageway, a scream of pain. I ran from Naomi's room and saw the one thing I could never imagine happening, not in my worst nightmares.
Chapter 109 The loud, deep-voiced call for help had come from Samson. My partner was in trouble. Two men, both wearing ghoulish masks, were struggling over him. Casanova and Rudolf? Who else could it be? Samson was down in the hallway. His mouth was open in shock and pain. A knife or ice pick protruded from the center of his back. It was a situation I had faced twice before, riding patrol on Washington's streets. A partner in trouble. I had no choice, and probably only one chance. I didn't hesitate. I raised my Glock and fired. I surprised them with the quick shot. They hadn't expected me to shoot while they were holding Samson. The taller of the monsters grabbed his shoulder and fell back. The other looked down the hallway at me. The cold glare of the fierce death mask was a warning. Still, I'd taken away their edge. I fired the pistol a second time, aiming at the second death mask. All the lights went out suddenly in the underground house. At the same time, rock and roll music erupted from speakers hidden somewhere in the walls. Axl Rose howled, "Welcome to the jungle." Pitch blackness fell over the hallway. The rock music shook the foundations of the building. I clung to the walls and moved steadily toward where Samson had gone down. My eyes pressed into the darkness and a terrible fear swept over me. They had jumped Samson, and that was no easy task. The two of them seemed to have appeared from nowhere. Was there another way in or out? I heard a familiar low growl. Samson was up ahead.
"I'm here. Guess I didn't watch my back," he gasped out the words. "Don't talk."
I moved closer to where his voice had come from. I knew approximately where he was now. I was afraid that maybe they hadn't left. They had just improved their odds, and I was sure they were waiting to jump me.
They liked to work two-on-one. They needed to twin. They needed each other. Together they were unbeatable, so far.
I inched my way along the wall, pressing against it with my back. I moved toward shapes and shifting shadows at the end of the passageway. There was a faint glimmer of amber light ahead. I could see Samson curled up on the floor. My heart was pounding so fast, there was barely a space between the beats. My partner was badly hurt. This had never happened before, not even when we were kids on the streets of D.C.
"I'm here," I said to Samson, kneeling beside him. I touched his arm.
"You bleed to death, I'll be pissed off," I told him.
"Just be real still."
"Don't sweat it. I'm not going into shock, either. Nothing shocks me anymore," he groaned.
"Don't be a hero."
I held his head lightly against my side.
"You've got a knife stuck in the middle of your back."
"I am a hero. Go on. You can't let them get away now. You already hit one. They're headed toward the stairs. The same way we came in."
"Go, Alex. You have to get them."
I turned at the sound of Naomi's voice. She knelt over Samson.
"I'll take care of him."
"I'll be back," I said.
Then I was gone. I turned a dark corner of the long passageway in a low, shooting crouch. I found myself entering the first corridor we'd come to.
"They headed toward the stairs," Samson had said. "Light at the end of the tunnel? Monsters hiding along the way?"
I moved faster in the semi-darkness. Nothing would stop me now. Well, maybe Casanova and Rudolf could. Two against one weren't the odds I wanted on their home field. I found the doorway out at last. There was no lock, no doorknob. I'd blown it away. The stairway was clear. At least it looked that way. The trap door was open. I could see dark pine trees and patches of blue sky overhead. Were they waiting up there for me? The two clever monsters? I climbed the wooden steps as quickly as I could. My finger was light on the Glock's trigger. Everything was surging out of control again. I exploded up the final stairs like an all-pro fullback through a small hole in the line of scrimmage. I burst from the rectangular opening in the ground, did a semi-acrobatic roll, came up firing the Glock. At the least, my combat routine might ruin somebody's aim. No one was there to shoot me or applaud my performance either. The deep woods were silent and appeared absolutely empty. The monsters had disappeared, and so had the house.
Chapter 110. I chose the same general direction that Samson and I had come in. It was definitely one way out of the woods, and it might be the route Casanova and Will Rudolph would take. I hated leaving Samson and the women, but there was no other choice, no other way. I stuck the Glock into my shoulder holster, and I started to run. Faster and faster as my legs began to work again, remembering how to run fast. A trail of fresh blood on leaves led a few yards into the thick undergrowth. One of them was bleeding heavily. I hoped he would die soon. I was on the right trail anyway. Vines and thorny bushes tore at my arms and legs as I moved through the densely overgrown thicket. The leafy branches whipped across my face. I didn't care about being whipped. I ran for what must have been a mile, or seemed like it. I was perspiring, and searing pains ripped through my chest. My head felt as hot as the engine of an overheated car. Every footstep seemed heavier than the last. For all I knew, I was putting distance between myself and the two of them. Or maybe they were right behind me. Maybe they had watched me come out, trailed me, circled around behind me. Two-on-one wasn't how I wanted this to go down. I looked for more signs of blood or torn clothing, some sign that they had been through here. My lungs were on fire now, and I was soaked with perspiration. My legs ached and were tightening up. I had a flashback, a rush of images. I was running with Marcus Daniels in my arms in Washington, D.C. I saw the poor little boy's face again now. I remembered hearing Samson scream in shock and pain back at the house. I saw Naomi's face. Something was up ahead. Two men were running. One of them was holding his shoulder. Was it Casanova? Or the gentleman? Didn't really matter. I wanted both of them. Wouldn't settle for less. The wounded monster showed no signs of slowing. He knew I was bearing down on him, and he unleashed a blood-curdling yell. It reminded me that he was an unpredictable madman of the highest order. The scream, "Yah!" echoed through the fir woods like the howl of a wild animal. Then another primal scream, "Yah!" It was the other madman. Twinning, I thought. They were both natural animals. They couldn't survive any more without each other. The sudden sound of gunfire caught me off guard. A chip flew off the bark of a pine tree and whipped past my head. It came within an inch or two of cutting me down, killing me on the spot. One of the monsters had turned around that fast, fired off a shot. I crouched behind the tree that had taken a bullet for me. I peered out through leafy branches. I couldn't see either of them up ahead. I waited, counted off the seconds, tried to get my heart to start again. Which one of them had fired the shot? Which one was wounded? They had been near a crest of a steep hill in the woods. Had they gone over the top? If they had, were they waiting for me on the other side? I slowly moved out from the safe cover of the tree and looked around. It was eerie and quiet again. No screams, no gunshots. No one seemed to be there. What the hell were they up to? I had just learned something new about them, though. I had another clue to go on. I'd seen something important a moment ago. I sprinted to the balding crest of the hill up ahead. Nothing. My heart sank. Fell a million miles into the abyss. Had they gotten away after all this? I kept running. I couldn't let this abomination happen. I wouldn't let the monsters go free. Chapter 111. I thought I knew the direction to the state highway, and I headed that way. I had my second wind, or maybe my third, and ran more easily now. Alex, the Pathfinder. Maybe 200 yards ahead of me, I spotted them again. Then I saw a familiar flash of gray, a curling ribbon of highway. I could make out a few white shingled buildings and ancient-looking telephone lines. A highway. The way for them to escape. The two of them were running in the direction of a shambling roadhouse. They still wore their death masks. That told me Casanova was in charge, the natural leader. He loved his masks. They represented who he believed he really was, a dark god, free to do whatever he chose, superior to the rest of us. A red and blue neon sign blinked trail dust on the roadhouse roof. It was one of those country gin mills that got good customer traffic all day. The monsters were heading that way. Casanova and the gentleman caller climbed into a late-model blue pickup truck parked in the lot. Busy tavern lots were a good place to park a car inconspicuously. I knew that as a detective. I raced across the state road toward the roadhouse. A man with long, frizzy red hair was just climbing into his Plymouth Duster in the parking area. He wore a wrinkled Coca-Cola work shirt and had a bulky brown bag shoved under one arm. Liquid groceries.
"Police!" I flashed my badge, a foot from his lightly bearded chin. "I have to take your car."
I had my pistol out, ready for trouble if it came at me. I was definitely taking the car.
"Jesus Christ, man, this here's my girlfriend's car,"
he drawled rapidly. His eyes stayed on the Glock. He handed over the car keys. I pointed back toward where I'd come from.
"Call the police right now. The missing women are back there, maybe a mile and a half. Tell them there's an officer down. Tell them it's Casanova's hideaway."
I jumped into the Duster and was doing 40 before I got out of the parking lot. In the rearview mirror, I could see the man with the six-pack still staring at me. I wanted to call Kyle Craig myself and have him send help, but I couldn't stop now, couldn't lose Casanova and his friend. The dark blue pickup headed toward Chapel Hill, where Casanova had tried to kill Kate, where he had originally kidnapped her. Was that his home base after all? Was he someone from the University of North Carolina, another doctor, someone we had never even heard of? Not only was that possible, it was likely. I closed to within four car lengths of them inside the city limits. No way to tell if they knew I was there. Probably they did. Chapel Hill's version of rush hour was in progress. Franklin Street was a narrow, winding stream of traffic rolling slowly alongside the tree-lined campus. Up ahead I could see the funky Varsity Theater, where Wick Sachs had gone to a foreign movie with a woman named Suzanne Wellesley. It had been adultery, nothing more, nothing less. Dr. Wick Sachs had been set up by Casanova and Will Rudolph. Sachs had made a perfect suspect in the case, the local pornographer. Casanova had known all about him. How was that? I was close to getting them now. I could feel it. I had to think like that. They caught a red light at the corner of Franklin and Columbia. Students wearing ratty T-shirts with Champion and Nike and Bass Ale logos jaywalked between the stopped cars. Shaquille O'Neal's "I Know I Got Skills" played loudly from somebody's radio. I waited a few seconds after the stoplight turned red with a noisy click-click sound. Then I went for the whole enchilada. Ready or not, here I come. Chapter 112. I slid out of the Duster and ran in a low crouch down the middle of Franklin Street. The Glock was out, but held flat against my leg to be less conspicuous. Nobody panic and scream now. Let this go right one time. The two of them must have spotted the trailing Duster earlier. I'd figured as much. As soon as I hit the street, they threw themselves out of opposite sides of the pickup. One turned and fired off three quick shots. Pop, pop, pop. Only one of them had a gun out. Something clicked inside my head again. I remembered a quick scene from the woods, a connection made, a flash of recognition. I ducked down behind a black Nissan Z that was waiting for the light and yelled at the top of my lungs, "Police! Police! Get down! Get down on the ground! Get out of these cars!" Most of the drivers and pedestrians did as they were told. What a difference between Chapel Hill and the streets of D.C. in that regard. I took a quick peek up the sheet metal lane between the cars. I didn't see either of the killers anywhere. I slid alongside the black sports car, bent over more than double in a low-slung crouch. Students and store owners watched me warily from the sidewalk.
"Police! Get down! Get down! Get that little boy the hell out of here!" I yelled.
I saw crazy things in my mind's eye, flashing images. Samson, with a knife in his back. Kate, after they had beaten her to a bloody, helpless mess. The sunken eyes of the women prisoners back at the house. I was keeping low to the ground, but one of the monsters saw me and went for a headshot. We both fired at almost the same time. His bullet barely nicked a side-view mirror that was between us. It probably saved me. I didn't see the result of my shot. I went down behind the cars again. The stench of motor oil and gas was almost overpowering. A police siren wailing in the distance told me help was on the way. Not Samson, though. Not the kind of help I needed. Just keep moving. Keep them both in sight somehow. Two of them. Two versus one. Better way to think about it. Two for the price of one. I wondered how well they would deal with this. What they were thinking, planning. Was Casanova the leader now? Who was he? I looked up quickly and saw a cop. He was near the corner of the street and his revolver was out. I never had a chance to shout a warning. A gun fired twice from his left and the patrolman went down hard. People were screaming all over Franklin Street.
Jaded college kids didn't look so blasé anymore. Some of the girls were crying. Maybe they finally understood that we're all very mortal.
"Get down!" I shouted again. "Everybody get the hell down!"
I ducked behind the cars again and inched my way up on the side of a minivan. I saw one of the monsters as my eyes cleared shiny silver sheet metal. My next shot wasn't so ambitious, no hero crap. I was willing to settle for a hit anywhere, chest, shoulders, lower torso. I fired. Trick shot, fuckhead. Watch this one. The bullet exploded through both passenger windows of a deserted Ford Taurus. It caught one of the bad guys high in the chest, just below the throat. He dropped as if his legs had been pulled from underneath him. I sprinted as fast as I could toward the place I'd seen him standing last. Which one went down? My brain was screaming. And where's the other one? I darted in and out between the parked cars. He was gone. He wasn't there. Where the hell was the one I had shot? And where was the other clever boy hiding? I saw the one I'd hit. He lay spread-eagled under the traffic light at Columbia and Franklin. The death mask still covered his face, but he looked almost ordinary in his white high tops, tan khakis, and windbreaker. I didn't see a gun anywhere around him. He wasn't moving, and I knew he was badly hurt. I crouched on my knees over him, my eyes darting around as I checked him out. "Careful, careful," I warned myself. I didn't see his partner anywhere. He's out there someplace. He knows how to shoot. I peeled the costume mask off his face, the last facade ripped away. "You're not a god. You bleed like the rest of us." It was Dr. Will Rudolph. The gentleman caller lay close to death in the middle of the street in Chapel Hill. His blue-gray eyes were glazing over. A sopping puddle of arterial blood had already collected under him. People were pushing in closer from the sidewalk. They were gasping in horror and awe. Their eyes stretched wide. Most of them had probably never seen anyone actually die. I had. I lifted his head. A gentleman. The murdering, maiming scourge of Los Angeles. He couldn't believe that he'd been shot, couldn't accept it. His darting, fearful eyes told me that much. "Who is Casanova?" I asked Dr. Will Rudolph. I wanted to shake it out of him. "Who is Casanova? Tell me!" I kept looking around behind me. Where was Casanova? He wouldn't let Rudolph die like this, would he? Two patrol cars finally arrived. Three or four local cops ran toward me with their guns drawn. Rudolph struggled to focus his eyes, to see me clearly, or perhaps to see the world one final time. A bloody bubble formed on his lips and then popped with a soft spray. His words came slowly.
"You'll never find him."
He smiled up at me.
"You're not good enough, Cross. You're not even close. He's the best ever."
A raspy howl rose from the gentleman's throat. I recognized the sound of the death rattle as I placed the death mask back over the monster's face. Chapter 113. It was a wild, jubilant scene, one that I would never be able to forget. The immediate families and close friends of the captive women kept arriving at Duke Medical Center all through the night. On the rolling hospital grounds and in the parking lot near Irwin Road, a large emotional crowd of students and townspeople gathered and stayed on past midnight. There were nothing but indelible images for me. Photographs of the survivors had been blown up and mounted on placards. Faculty and students held hands and sang spirituals as well as "Give Peace a Chance." For at least one night, everyone chose to forget that Casanova was still out there somewhere. I tried it for a few hours myself. Samson was alive and recovering inside the hospital. So was Kate. People I'd never met came up and fiercely shook my hand inside the suddenly festive facility. A father of one of the surviving victims broke down and wept in my arms. It had never felt this good to be a policeman. I took the elevator to the fourth floor to visit Kate. Before I walked into her room, I took a deep breath. Finally, I went in. She looked like a mysterious mummy with all of her head bandages and wraps. Her condition had stabilized. She wasn't going to die, but she remained in a coma. I held Kate's hand and I told her the long day's news. "The captive women are free. I was at the house with Samson. They're safe, Kate. Now you come back to us. Tonight would be a good night," I whispered. I ached to hear Kate's voice again, at least one more time, but no sound came from her lips. I wondered if Kate could hear me or make any sense of the words. I kissed her softly before I left for the night. "I love you, Kate," I whispered against her bandaged cheek. I doubted that she could hear me. Samson was located one floor above Kate. Man Mountain had already come out of surgery and his condition was listed as good. He was awake and alert when I came in to see him.
"How's Kate and the other women?" he asked me. "I'm about ready to leave this place myself."
"Kate's still in a coma. I just came from her room. Your condition is good, if you're interested."
"You tell the doctors to upgrade me to excellent." "I hear Casanova got away."
He started to cough, and I could tell he was angry.
"Take it easy. We'll get him."
I knew it was time for me to go.
"Don't forget to bring me my shades," he said as I left. "Too much light in this place. Feel like I'm in Kmart."
At 9:30 that night, I was back in Scucci's hospital room. Seth Samuel was there. The two of them were impressive to watch together. They were strong, but they were also sweet. I began the happy task of getting to know Naomi and Seth.
"Annie Scooch! Annie Scooch!"
I heard a familiar voice behind me, and it was the best sound. Nana, Scylla, Damon, and Janny all trooped into the room. They had flown in from Washington. Scylla broke down and cried as she saw her baby. I saw Nana Mama also wipe away a few tears. Then Scylla and Naomi were giving the word hug a new meaning. My kids watched their Auntie Scooch lying in the scary hospital bed. I could see the fear and confusion shining in their little eyes, especially in Damon's, who tries to rise above all forms of uncertainty and terror in his life. I went to my kids and scooped them up in my arms. I held them both as tightly as I could.
"Hello, son. Little cue ball in the side pocket. How's my Janny?" I asked. "For me, there's nothing like my family, nothing even close. I imagine that's part of why I do what I do. I know it is, Dr. Detective Cross."
"You found Auntie Scooch,"
Janny whispered into my ear. She hugged me tightly with her strong little legs and arms. She was even more excited than I was. Chapter 114. It wasn't over for me. The job was only half done. 2 days later, I trudged down a well-worn path through the woods separating Route 22 and the underground house. The local police officers I passed on the way were somber and quiet. They tramped out of the woods with their heads lowered, not talking with one another, their faces drained of color and effect. They had met the human monsters on an intimate basis now. They had seen the intricate and ghastly handiwork of Dr. Will Rudolph and the other monster who called himself Casanova. Some of them had explored the House of Horror. Most of them knew me by now. I was a regular at the Hellfires with them. Some nodded or waved hello. I waved back. I was finally somewhat accepted in North Carolina. 20 years ago, that wouldn't have been possible, not even under these extreme circumstances. I was beginning to like it in the South a little, more than I would have thought possible. I had a new notion, a plausible theory, about Casanova. It had to do with something I'd noticed during the gun battle scene in these woods and on the streets of Chapel Hill.
"You'll never find him," I recalled Rudolph's dying words. "Never say never, Will."
Kyle Craig was at the House of Horror that warm, hazy afternoon. So were about 200 men and women from the Chapel Hill and Durham police forces, as well as soldiers from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. They were getting to know the human monsters up close and personal.
"Extraordinary time to be alive, to be a cop," Kyle said to me.
His humor got a shade darker every time I saw him. He worried me. Kyle was such a loner most of the time, such a careeraholic. Apparently such a straight arrow. He had even looked that way in the Duke yearbook pictures I'd found of him.
"I feel sorry for these local people dragged out here for this," I said to Kyle. My eyes passed slowly over the ghoulish crime scene. "They won't be able to forget this until the day they die. They'll dream of it for years."
"How about you, Alex?" Kyle asked.
His intense, grayish-blue eyes leveled mine. Sometimes he almost seemed to care about me.
"Oh, I have so many nightmare images now,"
it's hard to pick out just one favorite, I confessed with a thin smile. I'll go home soon. I'll make my kids sleep in with me for a while. They love to anyway.